This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville. 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. The 100th anniversary of the National Park Service is a perfect opportunity to look back on all the people who have influenced the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and our perception of it. From hikers to writers, from colonels to scientists, it's an exhaustive list. Our guest on today's dialogue was given the task of reducing that list to 100 people, a task almost as monumental as the park itself. But Courtney Lix is here today to talk about the process, the park, and the people who made it what it is. Courtney's list of the 100 most influential people in the park's history appears in the most recent edition of Smokies Life magazine, and she's recently published a book called Women of the Smokies, profiling 19 women who left their indelible mark on the Smokies. So, Courtney Lix, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. It's a really delight to be here.
Now, you grew up in East Tennessee. Tell me what the park meant to you as a young girl growing up in Gatlinburg.
Sure. So I had a really deep connection to the park. My grandfather was a naturalist, one of the first park naturalists in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And so he taught me a lot about plants and animals, instilled in me a curiosity to look around, look under rocks, ask questions about what I was seeing. And really taught me to love the land. I grew up close to the Greenbrier part of the national park. Mm-hmm. So I've spent a lot of time walking up Porter's Creek and exploring that specific part of the park.
You live in Washington, D.C. now.
I do, yes.
Do you miss the Smokies?
Oh, every day, yes. The city is full of redbuds, which always make me homesick. I'll see some dogwoods, but, you know, it's not the same if you're not near a rushing river. The mist isn't rising off. I feel thankful that my writing has kept me connected back to the mountains, and I've come back a lot to do research and maintain that connection.
When you're in D.C. and people ask you about the Smokies, or you're telling them about the Smokies, what do you tell them?
I tell them that there's no place more beautiful on earth than the Smokies in springtime.
Do you have any specific memories of the park? You mentioned that your grandfather taught you, you know, about lifting up rocks and looking for the critters beneath and flowers and that sort of thing. Are there any particular memories that you have that stick with you now?
Oh, gosh. Which one to pick? I think I'll say the first time my dad and I hiked up Mount LeConte. LeConte is a very special place for a lot of people, mm-hmm. and I think for a good reason. It's definitely very challenging to get up to the
sure.
top. We took the Boulevard Trail up, and mm-hmm. it was an incredibly beautiful, clear day. Breezes without humidity kind of blowing across, and we went out to Myrtle Point, mm-hmm. and sat down and ate our completely smashed peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Of course, right.
And they tasted more delicious than almost any meal I've had in my life. And then when we were hiking back down, we went down Alum Cave, and we were sort of paused and admiring the view out across the valley, and something came out of the sky just out of nowhere, almost took my dad's head right off. It was a peregrine falcon.
Oh, wow.
And that was just breathtaking. And so all in all, just a very memorable time on the mountain.
That, and you said that was your first hike up mm-hmm. Mount LeConte. Mm-hmm. You've gone since.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've been back several times. And that time we didn't stay over.
Mm-hmm. But you have stayed over.
But yes,
it's a lot of fun,
isn't it? Stayed a couple of
it?
Times. It's so fun. It's so nice not to have to head back down.
Yeah, most certainly is.
Gotten,
you don't have to touch the top of the mountain and then turn around and go back down
yes,
right away.
Yes, exactly. Just yeah. take your boots off and change into your sandals and kind of kick back.
About how old were you when you took that trip?
I think around, maybe around 10, mm-hmm. 10, 11, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing you weren't the kind of girl who was squeamish about things like bugs and dirt and stuff like that.
No. I've been rescuing woolly bears out of the road for as long as I can remember. Mm-hmm. I was part of a salamander population monitoring project up on some unmarked branch off of Tremont when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. So we'd hike up and there would be these kind of, how to describe it, mesh bags filled with leaves that are great salamander habitat.
Oh, okay.
And so you'd hike up and you'd find the bags and sort of shake the salamanders loose and try to catch them. And then you'd weigh them and measure them and identify them. So that was a lot of fun contributing to park science as a kid.
Now, how did you get involved with this LIST project, coming up with a list of 100 most influential people in the history of the park?
Yes. Well, I think that I've written about enough people. I've been working on the Women of the Smokies book for 4.5 years at the point that Steve Kemp, the editor of Smokies Life magazine, brought up the idea of me writing this list. And I think I've gotten a reputation of being someone who can do a lot of research and then distill it down into 100 words. I mean, the profiles for each person, so that this list didn't go on and on forever.
Yeah.
The goal was to describe these incredible achievements in like 60 to 80 words, 100,
wow,
if I couldn't really help myself.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible challenge, really.
When we were talking on the phone the other day, you made a point to say this wasn't a case of you just coming up with a list and there it is. There was a whole process involved. Can you tell me about the process and some of the other people who were involved in coming up with this list?
Yes. I was listening to you do my introduction and thinking, I hope we get to talk about everyone else who was involved. So in addition to Steve Kemp, who is the editor and has been working in the Smokies for decades, we reached out to local historians, park scientists, and then also I think one of my favorite things was putting out the call through social media so that people could be involved. I think there are now over 300,000 people on the Great Smoky Mountains Association's Facebook page, and all of them were given the opportunity to suggest people. They didn't come up with any true surprises, but it's nice to give everyone a voice in putting together a list like this, for sure.
How long did it take to put together the list, and how did you, once you've collected all this information, how do you pare it down?
It's not easy. I think the list, probably months, definitely months, maybe even as long as 6 or 8 months. I'm not sure. Maybe the list was even being scribbled on the back of a notepad before I even got involved, you know?
Sure.
And then even as I was writing, the list was evolving as well. I think one of the interesting challenges with a project like this is how much time, how much space, how many people do you choose to honor the past with? And it's such an ongoing endeavor to keep the national park running and flourishing and to continue to study it. How many people who are around now making contributions do you include in that tension?
That's interesting, because on the one hand, we tend to look at something like a 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, and we're looking back in time. But a lot of the people are right among us right now who would easily make the list 100 years from now.
Yes, yes. And I think that was part of the goal, to be more forward-looking and honor and recognize the contributions that are going on right now and people who aren't finished contributing to. Quite a few of the park scientists who are on the list are still doing work and asking questions and getting things done.
Yeah, yeah. Now, aside from the obvious in that they are all influential in the park's history and in the park's operation, as we said, what do these 100 people share? Is there any sort of characteristic or anything that they share as you're looking for a commonality among all these 100 people?
I really like that question. I think I would say a strong sense of creativity. I think creativity would be the common attribute. You know, it took tremendous kind of vision to even think that there could be a national park. And I think it was challenging to people's strategy ideas. How do we really make this happen? And even today, figuring out how to effectively treat the hemlocks, hemlock woolly adelgid, that it takes, I'm sure, tremendous problem solving and creativity to figure out how to protect our trees. So from history to present day, I would say lots of creative people on the list.
And when you talk about the folks who were there at the very beginning talking about the creation of a park, it was, I don't know if controversial is the word, but it was certainly a different kind of idea, because up to that point, most of the national parks were out west. And they kind of had that flavor about it.
Yes, yes, exactly. I think the timing was so good in many ways. And Stephen Mather, who was the director of the Park Service at that time, had actually written in his own memos about how there should be a park in the East. And so there was support from very top level of the National Park Service. And then there was this very grassroots effort, and they sort of found great synergy.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard from people who have seen the list and said, well, hold it, you missed so-and-so?
You know, I think there were concerns about that happening.
Yeah.
I have only heard positive things from the list. Of course, I could probably name some people who, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, shoot, why didn't anyone, you know, mention, say, Lisa Horstman, who has contributed an incredible amount of books to children's literature about the Great Smoky Mountains. Her book, The Smoky Mountain Salamander Ball, is just one of my favorites. And I think has made many kids fall in love with the Smokies. And so, you know, I would just send up to Lisa, like, next time we do a list, you're on it.
Now, who are some of the people who are on the list that seem kind of obvious? These are people that most of us would be familiar with. An example might be Franklin Roosevelt.
Right, right.
Who are some of the obvious sort of notable people that are on that list?
Yeah, well, the list was definitely always going to have Ann Davis on it.
Tell us a little bit about Ann Davis.
Oh, sure. So Ann, as the story goes, was on a trip out west with her husband, Willis P. Davis, and they really enjoyed the scenery out there. They had a great time. And then they got back to Knoxville, and she sort of looked out at the mountains and said, well, this is just as breathtaking and special as what we saw out there. Like, why can't we have a park here? And Willis, tremendously influential businessman, kind of ran with this idea too, and was friends with Colonel David Chapman, mm-hmm. who also provided a lot of the get up and go energy for the park movement on the Tennessee side. And then Anne was elected to the legislature and was involved in some very important legislation for getting land dedicated to the national park. So she carried her passion all the way to Nashville and convinced politicians from across the state that this was an important thing to do.
How about some of the names of people we probably have never heard of, some of the more obscure names, but whose contributions were also quite big?
Sure. Do you mean to the establishment of the national park, or just
anywhere
in
along the park's history? Yeah, anywhere
sure.
In the last 100 plus years.
Well, one of the women who is also in my book, who is very influential in creating the park, is Laura Thornburg. Mm-hmm. And most of her photographs were donated to the national park after she died. So she hiked with Jim Thompson, who I think we all know, famous for his Smokies vistas, beautiful scenic pictures. And Laura was more focused on the people. And so she has a photograph of like a Civil War veteran playing a fife for his grandkids and people just sort of relaxing in their cabins. And she hiked with a lot of the National Park Service, federal level, people who were coming down. All they'd heard was that there was a lot of logging in the Smokies. And so they were sort of wondering, why are we coming down? Why do people want to protect this ravaged land? And so she was a voice for showing them, no, it's still filled with beautiful flowers. There are amazing rivers. It's still a very vibrant, alive place. And yet, I think you hardly ever hear her name as a contributor to establishing the park.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. Our guest today is Courtney Licks, and we're talking about some of the people who had a major influence on the Great Smoky Mountains National Park over the last 100 years. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or you can fill out the handy little box on our homepage, WUOT.org. And as always, you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT.
Margaret was a preacher's daughter, watched her sister fade away. Left her looking after Mama, but lost her to an early grave. She married well while she was still young. Kept looking, but she couldn't find her place in the sun. Come on, blues, find a path.
This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and I'm joined by Courtney Licks, author of the book Women of the Smokies. And we're talking about some of the women and men who have helped create, maintain, and improve upon the beautiful playground we call the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter or on Facebook. And if you go to our webpage, there's a neat little question box you can fill out, and we'll do our best to get your question to Courtney. And of course, you can just call us 974-5050, 974-5050. And Courtney, we're listening to a duo known as Butterfly Rose. Tell me a little bit about Butterfly Rose.
Sure. So Butterfly Rose is a Nashville-based Americana duo, Carol Zamora and Kay Pryor. And they, in 2014, released a CD, 10 original songs, called Women of the Smokies. And they embarked on this project before I knew them.
Oh, no kidding.
And they talked to my editor, Steve Kemp, as the their work was evolving. Mm-hmm. And he told them about my book. But they did the majority of the, all of the songwriting before I actually knew them. And so since then, we have kept in touch. It took me 2 more years to finish the book. But there's great complement between the songs that they've written and the women in the book. I started my sort of book tour on Monday, and they drove from Nashville, and we had a couple of events together where I would read and they would sing. And yeah, it's just been a wonderful time.
Oh, they were singing, who were they singing about in that particular song?
That was a song about Margaret Stevenson, who was an incredibly inspiring hiker. I'm sure many of your listeners know about her and maybe even have hiked with her. She was quite famous, I think. They called hiking with Margaret therapy on the trail because she was such a great listener, and you'd be walking along in the beautiful mountains and just feel like pouring your soul out to her, and she'd tell you everything's going to be all right. And she found a lot of strength and peace in the mountains. She was the first woman to hike all 900 miles of trail in the park. And she, I think, holds the female record for most times up Mount LeConte. Over 700 times.
Her boots are there, right?
Yes, and her boots are bronzed and kept in the lodge, as is her hiking journal. I think you can flip through that as well. She kept notes about which trails she went up and if they saw a bear or there was a terrible rainstorm, that kind of thing.
Now, I want to actually talk about some of the people that you mentioned in both the list and the book, Women of the Smokies. They were prolific hikers. Mm-hmm. We had people like Margaret Stevenson, Gracie McNichols, or McNichol, rather, and mm-hmm. Rufus Morgan. Tell me a little bit about who these people were and what they were up to.
Sure. So Gracie and Margaret both, I think, are particularly interesting because they weren't from around here. Gracie had been a nurse up in Alaska and had a sister in Knoxville, and she had overcome some pretty intense illness in her life. At one point in her early 30s, she had to learn to walk again. She had been so sick she hadn't really left her bed for 2 years. And so she arrived in the mountains and had didn't really quite know what she was getting herself into. And basically, the first hike she took was up to Alum Cave Bluffs. And she just fell in love with the mountain and hiked up, let's see, get my numbers right, over 200 times. And until Margaret came along, she was the person who had hiked the most, other than lodge staff. Obviously, they go up and down quite a bit.
Sure, right, right. Now, in the book, you mentioned that they kind of knew each other. They mm-hmm. but they weren't necessarily hiking in tandem.
No, they had very different hiking styles, in fact, and that was why I included them both in the book. I thought this was this lovely kind of contrast where they clearly felt a similar connection to the mountain, but Gracie liked to hike alone or with two hiking companions who would come with her generally when she got older. She was riding a horse up the mountain for her 92nd birthday.
Wow.
So quite a determined and spunky lady.
Yeah.
And Margaret was a much more social hiker. The more the merrier, as far as she was concerned. It was one of the things that kind of led to her being known as one of the main people who inspired other people who maybe had never hiked before to get out. And many, I think, people who have now completed all 900 miles of the trail would say, I never dreamed about doing this until I met Margaret.
There, you know, they were both hiking and logging a lot of miles and a lot of trips around the same time. Was there any kind of a friendly competition or rivalry there?
I would say not between them. Gracie and Rufus Morgan, Reverend Rufus, mm-hmm. there was. But I think by the time Margaret really got focused on Mount LeConte, Gracie was getting pretty old and starting to have some health problems. So her hiking days were getting limited. And I think Margaret was the type who would just be incredibly supportive. Mm-hmm. I don't know that she was particularly competitive, even under friendly circumstances,
sure.
Really. Yeah.
974-5050, 974-5050, if you have a number or if you have a question for our guest, Courtney Licks, who is the author of Women of the Smokies. She's our guest today on Dialogue. And I wanted to talk about three people that really kind of captured my imagination. They're Joseph Hall, Mary Ruth Childs, and Michael Montgomery. Who were they, and why are they important to this story, the story of the Smokies?
Yes. So these are three people who are on the Smokies Heroes 100 list. Mm-hmm. And so I would say things started with Joseph Hall. He was, I love this word, he was a song catcher. Mm-hmm. And as a graduate student at Cornell, got the opportunity to come down into the Smokies and bring his recording equipment. And he won over a lot of mountain people, got them to talk into his sound machine, and he recorded the way that they spoke, the mountain dialogue. Which was, this was in the late 30s, and so kind of a pivotal time before a lot of the original people had to leave what was becoming park boundary.
Mm-hmm.
So all of his recordings were kept probably a few different places, but Mary Ruth Childs was a secretary, longtime secretary with the Smokies National Park Service, and when she retired, she took it upon herself to create transcripts of all of Joseph Hall's recordings, and she came up with her own system of orthography, which is the way of indicating when you're writing something down the emphasis and pronunciation of it.
Because that would be quite a challenge, because you're talking about a very specific kind of dialect that doesn't necessarily fit into our kind of standard phonetic approach to pronunciation.
Exactly.
You're trying to transfer it onto to paper.
Yes, exactly. And make sure that nothing is being lost and that it can't be misunderstood, because mm-hmm. that would be what you were ultimately trying to avoid. So I think in going back to what I said earlier about people being incredibly creative, you know, she just worked with the existing types of orthography, and then when she needed something else, she made it up, and then so that was really pivotal work in making sure that Joseph Hall's research didn't just sit on the shelf. I'm sure someone would have come along eventually and done what she did, but I was just so struck by the fact that she had this full long career and then decided she would turn her attention to Joseph Hall's work as well.
Then where did Michael Montgomery come in?
And then Michael Montgomery worked on the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English, which is just such a beautiful book. I think moving, again, the research out of the realm of academia and people who are particularly interested in this kind of the old speech patterns, and making it something, I think it was sort of just a book that people had to have.
Mm-hmm.
And just a wonderfully accessible reference to not just pronunciations of words, but really phrases and a whole manner of speaking.
974-5050 is the number to call if you have a question for our guest, Courtney Licks, author of Women of the Smokies. And Chris is calling from Lenore City. Chris, welcome to Dialogue.
Well, hello there. How are you doing?
Good.
Great.
I got a question for Courtney.
Yeah.
Do you go to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in North Carolina and the Appalachian and Tennessee and Gatlinburg?
I do, yes.
I know. You go to here in North Carolina in Asheville and near those, you know, the bears, two of the bears?
I do. My first book was called Frequently Asked Questions About Smoky Mountain Black Bears. that was a while ago. I'm not sure I could, try to answer bear questions.
Do you work at the Sugarland Visitor Center in Gatlinburg?
I don't. I'm a freelance writer.
You're a freelance writer?
Yes, sir.
Well, Chris? I know. It's. I think, do you go to North Carolina and Virginia?
Well, I you live just outside of Virginia. So, Chris, let me just jump in here real quickly. Do you have a specific question for Courtney today?
Well, yeah, I got a question for Courtney. I think I tried to. It's near the mountains, near the Appalachia. It's near the North Appalachia,
yeah.
Near Murphy, North Carolina.
Yes, I know Murphy. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's in there in Waynesville, North Carolina, and it's in North Carolina, and it's in Maggie Valley, North Carolina, near the mountains.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling us today. And you know, Chris is talking about sometimes on the Tennessee side, we tend to think of just the Tennessee side, but the Smokies, North Carolina, the Smokies belong to North Carolina as well.
Yes, and I think that's a very, very important point to make. And something that we paid attention to in the list of top 100 people, and also in my book, it was very important to have women who lived in both Tennessee and North Carolina. And I think sometimes people might say, well, why isn't, let's say, Ann Davis is not in the book? I fully recognize her contribution and celebrate what she's done. But Tennessee women, North Carolina women, and the finite number of pages in a book, and you have to make calls to
sure.
kind of balance and honor that the park is in both states, for sure.
Well, let's talk about one of those Tennessee women for just a moment, and that's the name in the book that everyone recognizes is Dolly Rebecca Parton.
Yes.
In what ways has she influenced our perspective of the Smokies? And when I say our, I mean not necessarily those of us here, you know, within this certain radius of the Smokies, but people who have never been to the Smokies, maybe.
Right, right. So one of the things that really struck me about Dolly is that she did grow up in extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. Her childhood in the 50s reminds me of what I was reading about of mountain life in, let's say, the late 20s mm-hmm. as well. No running water. Her father, a sharecropper. And she has really embraced that. She has really said, this is where I came from, and I am a creative mountain woman, and this is what I've done. And so I think she has, for so many people, the perception of Appalachia as hillbillies and uneducated, Dolly has said, no, that's not who we are, and I am proud to be a representative of the East Tennessee Mountains.
Yeah, a few years ago, I know former Superintendent Dale Dittmanson referred to Dolly as the most recognized person who most personifies the love of the Smokies, and you've spoken to her. You get that sense from her?
Oh, yes.
That the Smokies are still very much a part of who she is in the way she goes through her day.
Yes. I think even when she's traveling, she said she'll look out from a stage and think about being back in the mountains. And a lot of what we talked about was her love of traditional mountain music. Her mother's side of the family was incredibly musical, and her mother would sing a lot of these traditional Appalachian ballads that are, you know, very sad and pretty dark.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And she said they were like their movies. You know, her mom would sort of get humming, and the kids would settle down and think like, all right, well, mom's gonna tell us a story, put on a show. And that was the music that I think has really stayed with her throughout her life. You know, I think we. Those of us who don't write songs might not appreciate how many songs you write before you get one that goes mm-hmm. on the CD, say.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things we talked about was how many of these kind of dark traditional ballads that she'll just write down, just sort of this outpouring of song, but a lot of them go in the drawer.
No
but,
kidding.
But that's
we
what
never
she's
get a chance
really
to
connected to. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of music, we had a question submitted by Shotzi before the show. She says, I've heard the music that came from the mountains was more pure to its native land because the mountain people didn't have much interaction with those in the valley. Did the creation of the Smokies National Park end most of that isolation in southern Appalachia, or only in that one specific area surrounding the park?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. The park definitely ended a lot of isolation, and a lot of mountain communities were kind of scattered out. I think that the traditional mountain music has still been handed down, mm-hmm. And because it was such a critical part of life, it hasn't been forgotten, But much of the traditional speech, of course, has changed.
Yeah, and as we were talking about this a little bit before the show, a lot of other things have influenced that isolation as well. We have automobiles, you know, and, mm-hmm. and roads, of course. We have the internet. We have television. We have all these different things that probably worked in tandem with the Park Service in an unintended way.
Right. I think even if the park hadn't been created, that isolation would have ended as well. And I will also say that, one of the women in my book is in Cataluci in its heyday in kind mm-hmm. of the early 1900s. And they had wagon roads out. They went to Waynesville. It definitely people got out and went to town and interacted with the outside world as well. So in some ways they were isolated. In some ways that's a little bit of a myth too.
We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. I know we have a couple calls waiting, and we will try to get to them after the break. Our guest today is Courtney Lixon. We're talking about some of the people who had a major influence on the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. If you want to participate, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or fill out that little box on our homepage. And as always, you can call us at 974-5050. It's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT.
Mom and Dad read books to little Wilma, and later on inspired her to write. Her words flow just like the French Broad River underneath the Smoky Mountain skies. With a pen in her hand, she brought honor to her.
This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and I'm joined by Courtney Lix, author of the book Women of the Smokies. We're talking about some of the women and men who have helped create, maintain, and improve upon the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook. You can go to our webpage, or you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And the music, again, that we were listening to is from Butterfly Rose, who has done, it's a duo that has done a CD called Women of the Smokies.
Yes, and that song was about Wilma Dykeman, who's one of my favorite women, who is also in the book, a fantastic writer, conservationist from Asheville originally.
Yeah, you know, a few years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing Wilma Dykeman about a year before she passed away. I want to play a clip from this interview in which she talks about how difficult it was to be in an assisted living facility at that time.
I wanted to just get out and walk in the country and smell it. And all the different smells of the seasons, too. You know, the seasons and the smell of snow and rain, the smell of rain and water, you know. It just all goes together, you know. You see it, you smell it, you taste it, you feel it, you touch it. That's what we're all about. Why were we given five senses if we weren't supposed to take them in?
Let me give you my impression of her, if I may.
Please.
She was petite, but there was nothing small about her. Tell me a little bit about what made her such a larger-than-life figure.
Oh, Wilma. I think she had such a great sense of humor. I think the quote isn't coming to me right now, but she, I think... She said that humor, you know, gets you through hard times and helps you celebrate little things, too.
Mm-hmm.
And she cared so deeply about the mountains. She was in a position as an incredible writer to kind of lift up the stories. I love The Tall Woman so much because it embraces the real history of the mountains around the Civil War, which is that particularly in East Tennessee, Western North Carolina, there was definite conflict between people who are Confederates and people who were Union sympathizers,
right.
Sometimes within individual communities. And so The Tall Woman looks at the legacy of that, looks at it. It's about a woman who wants to bring education to her community. And I think in all of Wilma's work, I love that you played that clip because water is so important and meaningful to her. When she was born, her parents' house was by Beaver Dam Creek in Asheville,
yeah.
And you could hear the sound of the water in the house. And so I think that that love of the life-giving force of water and its sound and smell clearly never left her.
974-5050, 974-5050. Let's go to Catherine, who's calling from Gatlinburg. Catherine, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you for the show today. I'm really enjoying it, Matt and Courtney, and the beautiful music by Butterfly Rose. Yeah, so Courtney, I'm looking forward to reading your book. Thank you for shining a light on these important folks.
Well, thank you.
So here's my question. You mentioned earlier in the interview that you spent time up in Greenbrier. We spend a lot of time hiking up in Greenbrier, and we're always fascinated by the old homesteads and the, you know, the signs of the communities from the past that lived up there, and kind of looking for sources of information to sort of study up on, you know, what was there and who lived where, and you know, where was the schools and the churches and this kind of thing in that community, sort of to tie together the past and the present. And I guess I'm going back 100 years.
Oh, definitely, at least.
At the very least. Catherine, thank you so much for the call.
Looking for, if you can point me in the direction of any really good sources of information on the history of that area.
Thank you, Catherine.
Sure. I would say I think you should take a trip over to the Sugarlands Visitor Center and talk to them. Right off the top of my head, I think to really get a good sense of the Greenbrier area, what I'm thinking of would require you kind of pulling information from quite a few different books, like the Hikes of the Smokies will have some information embedded with the descriptions of the hikes. There's also a History Hikes of the Smokies. I think Charles Maynard wrote that. And that will probably have some really good information on some of those Greenbrier area trails, like Old Settlers Trail. I would say just kind of see if they can give you something more targeted. But I know that there's another book on cemeteries of the Smokies. And so there are quite a few cemeteries in Greenbrier. So that would be like a third one to add to your stack. I don't know if there's actually a book specifically about Greenbrier, but hopefully Steve Kemp at the Great Smoky Mountains Association is listening and making notes.
I was just going to offer that as a suggestion as well. When you were writing the book, Women of the Smokies, Courtney, were there any stories or anecdotes that you read that just wouldn't let you go, just kind of captivated you about some of the characters that were in the book?
Oh, gosh. So many. I think I will talk first about Karen Wade, who mm-hmm. was the first and currently only female superintendent of Great Smoky Mountains, and she arrived in 1994. And under her superintendency, the All-Taxa Biodiversity Inventory was started.
And yeah, I wanted to talk about that a little bit, too. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I guess it would be important to talk about what that is first.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Basically, Keith Langdon, one of the park biologists, heard about this study that was going on down in Costa Rica to inventory, to find and catalog every form of life in this rainforest in Costa Rica, an incredible undertaking. Mm-hmm. And of course, he thought, well, the Smokies would be a great place to do this too. Why don't we see what we can do about this? And so he talked with Phil Francis, who was deputy superintendent at that time, and Karen, and they both agreed that this kind of groundbreaking research is something that Great Smoky Mountains National Park should be involved in. And so the project was going on, and there was a maintenance crew up some of the high elevation on the Appalachian Trail, mm-hmm. and they found this giant earthworm. Mm-hmm. And they'd heard about the ATBI going on, and they thought, well, I wonder if anyone has cataloged this worm, giant worm. So they caught it. They brought it back down the mountain.
I want to point out, as you're telling me the story, your hands are about a foot apart. Was the worm that big?
It was somewhere somewhere between 8 inches and a foot, yes.
Oh, wow.
I'm sure as we tell
worm.
The story, the worm grows.
Yeah,
but
that's right. It was a 4-foot worm.
So this worm was pronounced to be, I think, a new species. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm a writer and not a scientist. But I'm pretty sure it was a new species. And so they brought the worm into Karen and said, we found this new species of worm. And so she was telling me the story, and she said, I just saw that worm as a symbol of a great thing.
Wow.
I just love that.
And since then, the inventory has, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but... I think
it's 9,000.
9,000 different species mm-hmm. of creature
yes,
living
I think
in the...
possibly mostly invertebrates.
Yeah.
But yes, a pretty staggering number.
And I know this is not a question for you, but I would imagine for the people who embarked on that originally, if they'd had seen 9,000, that number 9,000, they probably would have said, well, yeah, there are a lot, but not that many. Or maybe they wouldn't have. Maybe they knew all along.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question. For Keith, at some point, I'm sure I'll corner him at some point and ask, did you ever dream of this?
Now, there are certainly some people who were negatively affected by the creation of the park. And these were people who were, in some cases, lost their family land. How did you negotiate this kind of sensitive area when you were compiling the list and writing the book?
Oh, another good question, Matt. I think it's, you know, in just saying it's something important to recognize, I think the only way to really go wrong is to pretend like it didn't happen and like mm-hmm. that people weren't asked to make sacrifices. I think in telling the stories of what was there and particularly in Cataluci, the fantastic flourishing community that was there that just kind of got torn apart, makes you appreciate more what we have now. I think most people agree that the park is significant and important and overall a positive contribution to our area, to the world. And yes, I like talking about what was required to make it what it is.
You know, one of the things that struck me on the list is that it's not just people on the list. There are some groups and organizations, and I noticed even a government program on the list, the Civilian Conservation Corps. Why was the CCC included?
Well, the park would not look like what it is today without them. I mean, so much of the trails, the roads, all of the beautiful stonework that I think gives such a sense of place when you're driving through the mountains was CCC work. And I think it's completely appropriate and important to raise up what they did for this land as well.
We talked a little bit just briefly about Jim Thompson, the photographer. There were a couple photographers that were on the list as well, people like Dutch Roth, Bill mm-hmm. Hindley. And I want to talk about them for just a moment, but keeping in mind that there are a lot of beautiful photos that come out of the Smokies now. And after people take those photos, they take their iPhone and slip it into mm-hmm. the back pocket.
Sure.
When you consider that some of these photographers were lugging lots of gear down these pretty remote paths, it's pretty impressive to think about that.
Oh, yes, yes. I would love, you know, like how they... recreated the Voyage of the Kon-Tiki. Mm-hmm. I would love to have some people take their old-time photo gear, and you couldn't stay on a trail. I think you'd to really have an authentic recreation of what this was like, you'd sort of have to go off trail in hauling something, let's say 12 pounds, 15 pounds, glass that you didn't
yeah.
want to break, don't fall. And getting up to some of these high peaks. And that's why Laura Thornburg, who I mentioned earlier, she was quite petite as well, maybe 5'2". Mm-hmm. And she would sometimes have her photo gear packed by a horse,
okay,
which isn't an option today, but quite practical
then. Now, some of these photos, what role did they play in bringing the Smokies to the rest of the world?
Well, I think the land was known as a place that had been logged, and had lost a lot of its ecological value. And I think the photos played a huge role in convincing folks who were never going to travel to the mountains to see it for themselves that there was so much natural beauty still left here, and building that kind of emotional resonance that the place was still wild and beautiful and comparable to what people could see out west.
Do you worry at all about the future of the park?
Well, I think that there are a lot of challenges with climate changing, with invasive species. I think that the park has a lot of incredibly capable people, but there's a lot to be concerned with, for sure.
If you could see 100 years into the future, what would the park look like?
Oh my gosh, now you're testing my creativity. Well, I would hope that we've found a way to get rid of the hemlock adelgid, that once again there will be incredibly green slopes. I would also hope that, you know, maybe with maybe there won't be cars. Maybe the park will be still even wilder than it is today. And people will still be able to kind of adventure into clear mountain streams and see a vibrant brook trout population and really just find themselves lost in nature.
Well, Courtney Lix, we are out of time here on Dialogue. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. And thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Where are you going next?
So thank you so much for having me, Matt. This has mm-hmm. been such a delightful conversation. And so today I'm headed over to Asheville. I'll be at Malaprops. For your Knoxville listeners, I'll be at Union Avenue Books on Saturday at 1, and that's where people can find the book in Knoxville.
Well, again, thank you, Courtney. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones today. And thank you for listening and calling and sending your questions. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in about an hour or so. Just go to WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.